Over the past 40 years, I've visited the city of Liverpool reasonably often, enjoying as I do the unique culture of its Scouser inhabitants that make it like an independent republic in the northwest corner of Britain. It's a city on the up and up these days, but it certainly wasn't like that when I first came upon it in the 1970s. Derelict docklands, a decaying inner city, and rising unemployment made for a depressing vista as I made my way to Paddy's Wigwam, as the Catholic Cathedral is called by the locals, for meetings of a charity the college supported. Sometimes things have to get worse before they get better, and that's certainly what happened during the Toxteth riots in 1981, when rioters fought police for 9 days, destroying 100 cars, damaging 70 buildings, injuring 468 policemen, and getting 500 of their number arrested. It was a wake-up call to the government, and after a shaky start, Liverpool has become something of an example of how to put Humpty Dumpty back together again in urban renewal terms. In fact, the network of streets where the riots first started has recently won an Architects Award for new urban design. However, you can redesign a city until you're blue in the face, but it will only get you so far unless you do something about the people who live in it. There is something in Liverpool's past that's hard for its inhabitants to live down. Its prosperity and rise to urban greatness was off the back of the slave trade, when it was a commercial centre for that appalling trade in human misery. That was, I think, a generator of bad karma for the generations that were to follow, only partially made up for by the city becoming the headquarters of Western Approach's command in the defeating of Hitler's U-boats. This morning, we're listening in to the greatest urban renewal project of them all, the Holy City, the New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven. Speaking as a very urban animal, who is often somewhat blind to the joys of the countryside, I rejoice in this promise that the life of the world to come will be centred in a city, remembering as I do the comment of one wit that the Bible starts in a garden and ends in a city. But if God is going to live among men and make his home among them, he is going to have to do something about renewing them and making them fit for purpose as dwellers in the heavenly Jerusalem. The promise made from the throne, "Now I'm making the whole of creation new," will involve some sorting out of prospective heavenly inhabitants. God has made some very specific promises and directives about what he will and won't permit in the life of heaven. Evil, sin, and death will be banished. That is why there will be no more weeping, mourning, or sadness. God will not permit us to sin anymore, for that is collusion with evil, and evil is what causes us to suffer. Those who have colluded with evil to the point where it's taken them over and has mastery of them will be excluded from the kingdom. The perpetrators of human misery will not walk the streets of the heavenly Jerusalem. This renewing and reordering of people for a new life in the new Jerusalem is to be accomplished in the most paradoxical way, in an extraordinary strategy outlined in some final words of Jesus in John's Gospel. As Judas departs into the darkness to start the ball rolling on the preordained drama of the Passion, a startling perspective is offered on what is about to take place. When Jesus is raised on the cross, this will be a moment of glorification, for as he ascends upon the tree of Calvary, he will exert tractor beams of attraction, drawing many to himself to ascend with him to be elevated into a new mode of existence. They will receive an elevation of character, a greater density of being, as they begin to live by the new law of love, to love one another as he has loved them. The kind of love generated by the new law of love has nothing to do with the kind of sentimentalized spirituality peddled by various debased forms of contemporary Christian expression. It's not the love we hear about in pop songs and see in romantic comedy films. It's not the kind of calculating, self-promoting love to be found in self-help books. It's about the kind of love that dethrones the ego, that rolls back the selfishness and needy, greedy love, that looks out on the world of significant people in our lives with steely-eyed attention to what is required to serve their best interests. pour love in where there's no love, and you'll draw love out, as John of the Cross wrote. The new law of love and the changes in lifestyle that go with it, when the message has been taken on board, look ahead to what will be on offer at Pentecost, a highlight of the Christian year that we're now very close to. Pentecost is about, among other things, the Holy Spirit as a source of continuing change in people's personality and in people's understanding of themselves. Those people on whom the Spirit descended then became transformed people, or rather the change process already begun in them since the resurrection appearances of Jesus was speeded up. They could truly say with Paul, "It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me." The Holy Spirit has stirred up their whole being and changed their whole nature. This morning we've been offered a vision of end-time glory, a reminder of the attracting, drawing power of the love of Christ crucified, and a radical command to love as Christ loves us. Where does that leave us in how we shall live in the week ahead? One of the strong cards we're holding, an asset that we make use of all too infrequently when giving an account of the hope that is within us to those on the margins of the church and to those uncertain of the Christian hope, is an enthusiastic account of what comes next after we end the brief span of life here on earth. It's not true that we've been given few details of what to expect in the life of heaven. I spent 3 years of enjoyable intensive study on this topic when completing my Master of Theology thesis. The Bible and the brightest minds in the church have had plenty to say on this subject, and it's not hard to find out more about it. The image of the New Jerusalem speaks to us about the communal nature of life in the world to come. We shall not be lonely. All the best things about urban living, the many and varied kind of people we encounter there, the considerable variety of services and opportunities on offer, are a foretaste of what shall be and the what will be. Am I suggesting a very materialist account of this urbanville utopia? But then Christianity is a very materialist religion. This morning, we're proposing to take the risen life of Christ within us by toasting him in wine and by sharing a symbolic communal meal with him. As for this morning's gospel challenge to us, I shall try to think long and hard in the week ahead about how I go about loving the significant people in my life. Have I dethroned my ego as I try to draw near to them? To what extent am I able to get the self out of the business of loving others, to be an unselfish friend whom others are glad to include in their lives? If I am truly seeking their best interests, let it not be a cold-blooded analytical calculation, but a warm-hearted and generous gift of self, accompanied by humour and generosity. I will change the familiar slogan WWJD, what would Jesus do, to HWJL, how would Jesus love, in this particular situation, with this particular person. Spoken in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.